Sky News Centre at 6. British troops could be home from Afghanistan before the next election. The Prime Minister's told us our forces can't be there for another 5 years, but David Cameron's voiced a note of caution. Speaking ahead of the G8 summit in Canada, he's warned we mustn't repeat past mistakes by cutting ties with Afghanistan completely.
We walked away and allowed them to become the badlands they became. So yes, let's get the conditions so the troops can come home, but let's remember that there should always be diplomatic missions and trade missions in Afghanistan as part of a very strong relationship.
A man's been convicted of taking part in Britain's biggest jewellery robbery. 24-year-old Aman Kasai forced a shop assistant at Graff Diamonds in central London to help steal gems worth £40 million last August. £67 billion has been wiped off the value of BP shares since the start of the oil spill disaster in April. The fallout from the leak in the Gulf of Mexico has sent stock plummeting to a 14-year low. There's been disappointment at Wimbledon for John Isner, the winner of the longest match in tennis history yesterday. He's been knocked out after defeat in the second round. Isner was thrashed in straight sets by Thiemo de Bakker of the Netherlands. The American admits he just ran out of steam.
Mentally and physically, I was obviously a bit drained. You know, I just didn't have much in the way of my legs and my shoulder, really everything just... And I was just low on fuel out there, really, so I didn't really have a chance.
Brazil and Portugal have played out a goalless draw in their final World Cup group game in Durban. Both sides are through to the last 16, the South Americans as group winners, Portugal as runners-up. And 40 years of Glastonbury's being celebrated tonight with Gorillaz. Damon Albarn's cartoon band stepped in when U2's Bono pulled out with a bad back. Music fans are set to enjoy scorching sun instead of the usual mud. That's the latest. I'm Kelly Withers.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Visit our website www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Are you discouraged or disheartened? Are you in distress or in debt? Do you feel that you are unlucky? Does your child need help with schoolwork? If you have answered yes to any one of the questions, come and learn how to become a champion and be victorious over these challenges using dynamic biblical principles at Champions House. Every Sunday, 12 to 2, City Academy, Bristol, Carlton House, Redfield. www.championshouse.com.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. 6 years ago, at the cost of hundreds of thousands of pounds, the BBC produced the Balin Report into their coverage of the Middle East conflict. In a staggering decision, though, BBC bosses refused to publish the report, even spending tens of thousands more licence fee payers' money on lawyers to block a private court case, which challenged their decision to keep it secret. And just a couple of days ago, we heard again that another legal challenge, the BBC have successfully stopped this report being published. We'll be hearing that in the Israel-Palestine conflict, Money Talks. Film director Ken Loach gives his assessment in a minute of what he sees as a massive pro-Israeli bias at the BBC. And a month on, we hear from Prishpon's kebab man, Shakir Yildirim, who found himself facing trigger-happy Israeli commandos armed only with a fire extinguisher to defend himself. And is there a secret government, a parallel government in the West? We hear an amazing speech from assassinated US President John F. Kennedy and hear about a close scrape with a homegrown military coup here in Britain in the 1970s. But first, Neil Evans is here to examine the medical justification for the proposed badger cull. Hi, Neil, and welcome back to Drive Time.
Afternoon, Tony. Nice to be here. Yeah, this is a very curious thing. I mean, anyone who's ever sort of watched Spring Watch or Autumn Watch or any of those kinds of programmes, you know, might have marvelled at the sight of these nocturnal creatures, the badger population, and many no doubt regard these as both adorable and a quintessential part of the English countryside. However, for many dairy farmers, badgers are considered a threat to their very livelihoods, as it is claimed that badgers are the main carriers of bovine tuberculosis, a disease that regularly infects livestock whenever badgers come into close proximity with cattle. And they have announced a change of approach, the new coalition government. They've cut a project that they were committed to vaccinate badgers against bovine TB that was planned to be rolled out over parts of England this summer. The new Agriculture Minister, James Pace, has told MPs that a pilot vaccination project will now only take place near Stroud, so not a million miles away from here. Programmes that were to take place in Herefordshire, Worcestershire, Staffordshire, Devon have all been scrapped. Now, Mr. Pace said culling badgers was also being looked at, so it's back on the agenda. And the project in Stroud is due to start in July. It will continue for 5 years, over which time the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA to you and me, say an estimated £6 million will be saved. So cost is very much at the heart of this as well. The government, when I spoke to DEFRA, they said that badgers would be trapped and vaccinated over a 38-mile square mile area of cattle farmland near Stroud, and that set surveys would be carried out in an area near Cheltenham. Now, badgers, as I've just said, are blamed by farmers for spreading TB, which affects cattle. Badger culling was also ruled out by the previous government. Mr. Pace said, "We've committed to carefully managed and science-led badger control as part of a package of measures, and we're looking carefully at badger vaccination and culling as part of that." And he went on to say that it makes sense to review the badger vaccine deployment project by keeping our options open and to ensure best possible use of taxpayers' money. By going ahead with the training in Stroud, we'll maintain the capacity to train lay vaccinators whilst we consider how best to deploy vaccines as part of badger control policy. Now, both sides of this argument passionately disagree about the science and the causes of TB in cattle, so much so that a recent plan by the Welsh Assembly to embark on a cull of badgers has now been successfully challenged by the Somerset-based Badgers Trust, the main organisation that was set up to protect the interests of these wild creatures, and the case will now be heard in the High Court in London in June. Closer to home, and making the news in recent nights, a West Country teenager believes the government's not doing all it can to tackle the problem of TB in cattle. 15-year-old Catherine Bigwood, who is a farmer's daughter and also does some farming herself, has now set up a Facebook group calling for urgent action, i.e. culling. The new government has said it's committed to a cull of badgers, so they still believe in the process. Catherine and her father have expressed their anguish over the prospects of losing their pedigree herd of cattle over what they claim is the unchecked spread of TB from nearby badgers. For farmers like Catherine and her family, it is, they say, not just about the loss of income and the slaughter of their cattle that will inevitably bring. There is the emotional attachment to their animals that has led Catherine to set up a Facebook group. So, what's the background to this story? According to a recent report on BBC's Countryfile programme, over 40,000 cattle are slaughtered each year because of exposure or the risk of exposure to bovine TB, mainly as a precautionary measure to avoid the spread of infection to more cattle. Now, this comes at enormous cost to the UK taxpayer, costing in the region of £100 million in controlling the disease and compensating farmers for their losses. The government have a statutory duty to compensate farmers for, as you found in the foot and mouth crisis, they have to be compensated for the loss of animals that is not their fault, basically. Now, but with the new coalition government set to scale back its planned programme of badger vaccinations based on cost, the minister argues the development of an oral vaccine for both cattle and badgers is the way forward, but he has admitted that this is still at least 5 years away from being available. On Farming Today, on Radio 4, the Shadow Agriculture Minister, Hilary Benn, former minister himself, has criticised the decision and the government's continued commitment to the culling of badgers. And he maintains that most people in the country are opposed to badger culling and question how much money would indeed be saved because of the costs associated with culling. OK, why is this issue so important in the first place? Well, it was a chap called Robert Koch, who lived between 1843 and 1910, was the scientist that proved that human TB was caused by a microbacterium, and expressed doubt he actually initially expressed doubts that bovine TB could infect man, but acknowledged that he had little evidence on which to base his opinion. And a royal commission was set up to explore the situation, and in an unprecedented move, it was charged with conducting its own research rather than simply collecting evidence from supposedly independent but usually biased witnesses. The commission, which published an interim report way back in 1904, demonstrated transmission of the organism from cow to man and called for urgent legislation to combat the menace. And that therein lies the real issue. The issue is that the established wisdom is that it can be passed through the food chain to human beings from dairy products or presumably the meat of cattle as well, which is why these beasts have to be slaughtered. As we can see, this is not a new issue then by any means, and several government reports have been issued since, the most recent being the Independent Scientific Group report of 2007, which was made to the then Environment Secretary and current Labour Party leadership candidate David Miliband. The report concluded that, and I'm quoting from the report, badger culling cannot meaningfully contribute to the future control of cattle TB in Britain. It goes on to state that our results indicate that whilst badgers contribute significantly to the disease in cattle, cattle-to-cattle transmission is also very important in high incidence areas and is the main cause of disease spread to new areas. And that is another important point of debate here. Commerce dictates that cattle moved around within and between countries, and animal welfare organisations claim that badgers therefore cannot be held accountable for many of the instances of TB. The new government now appears to take a different view, and they are determined to bow to industry pressure from the National Farmers Union and others to take a more hardline stance on this subject. So, finally, what is the way forward from here? Well, with politicians, animal groups and a sizeable minority of the farming community at loggerheads over the best way forward, the best hope for the future is the development of this oral vaccine for both cattle and badgers. As mentioned, this is not on the horizon immediately because there are a number of issues to be resolved. Firstly, the EU would need to broadly agree a policy because of the trade implications. Jim Pace, the minister, pointed out it's important to have a vaccine that could be identified when tested. So if an animal is exported and tests positive for TB, you need to know whether that animal actually has TB or is just tested positive for being inoculated with the virus. And he also said there's a pressing need to deal with the issue now rather than wait for a vaccine to finally become freely available. Now, of course, organisations like the Badgers Trust will never accept the need for culling and will continue their campaigns to protect what they see as a much-loved and unique creature as part of the British countryside.
Thanks very much, Neil. Now, also joined on the line from Lampeter in Wales by George Lumby. Hi, George, can you hear me?
It's Gordon.
Oh, it's Gordon. Gordon, yeah. Lumby. Hi, Gordon.
Could you
give us your view on the whole badger culling business? I know you're campaigning there against it. Why is that?
Well, there's so many anomalies within this situation, and I'll start at the beginning. The first thing is how the cattle are found to have bovine TB by a skin test. Yeah. And the Welsh Assembly Government has admitted to us that it is only 80% accurate. We said 60, but they've said 80, and we accept that. Now, you get lots of stories from farmers who say, I was tested positive for bovine TB, my farm went on stop. And it was on stop, say, for two or three tests. Then I was tested negative again, and things started to move. But suddenly, I had another test, and it's positive again, and everything's on stop. And they can't understand, and the only thing that they can see is badgers. What they don't understand is that this test is missing out cattle that have bovine TB and are left in the herd. Do you understand that?
Yeah.
And this is causing a lot of problems. Now, there is another test called the gamma interferon. But well, we're constantly asking if when the cattle get the skin test, they also get the gamma interferon at the same time. and therefore you will find all the cattle that have got bovine TB.
Well, look, George, then, George, what's your interest in this? Why have you taken it to heart?
Because I'm a conservationist. I mean, I've not only done badgers, I've done red kites. I've been involved with red kites. I've been involved with otters. You know, otters were killed by PCBs and things like that. We're trying to stop the dredging of the scallop beds in Cardigan Bay because they're destroying the seabed, stuff like that. It's going on all around, you know.
What's your view as to why this is happening, if you don't agree with the science?
Why it's happened? Well, I mean, initially, just after the war, bovine TB was 40% in cattle. And they put strict movement on cattle and tested and tested and tested, and they got it down to less than 1% without killing one badger. I know that farmers say, yes, we did kill badgers. Well, if they did, they shouldn't have been doing. But they didn't kill badgers. I was talking the other day to a gentleman who was a retired slaughterman and butcher. He started work in 1952, and he said there was two problems then in the meat industry. First of all, there was rationing, and secondly, the cattle that were coming in were a lot of them were infected with bovine TB. They were called grapies because the lesions were like a bunch of grapes inside the crash, the chest cavity. Yeah, and he said that he knows full well that it wasn't. They didn't kill any badgers in those days. They finally eradicated it by strict testing. Strict movement of cattle. Yeah,
George, if I can come in here, it's Neil Evans here. I've just done the piece leading up to.
Sorry, I tried to listen to that.
Okay, not to worry.
My name's Gordon as well.
I'm sorry, Gordon. I do beg your pardon. Given the accepted wisdom that an oral vaccine for both cattle and badgers is probably at least 5 years away.
Not true.
Is that not the case?
Yeah, I'll just read you something here. initially, a vaccine, you won't believe this, a vaccine was developed in 1985. A gentleman was asked by the Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Fisheries, because slowly bovine TB was on the increase again.
And was that an oral vaccine?
It was a vaccine, an injectable vaccine, and it was developed and tested, and it worked. But the then Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Fisheries got rid of it because of politics.
Well, an injectable vaccine, I know, does exist, but I was talking about an oral vaccine, which is obviously easier to administer.
Just let me continue. In 2007, there was Dr. Jane Hope and colleagues at the Institute of Animal Health's Compton Laboratory, they developed a test that can distinguish cattle that have been vaccinated against bovine TB from those that have been infected by the causative agent, the bacterium Microbacterium bovis. Now, this is what's stopping them vaccinating cattle, because Europe says that there's no way you can differentiate between a cow that's been vaccinated and a cow that's got that's had bovine TB or got bovine TB.
Just one more question. How do you feel about the new coalition government's change of policy? I said in my piece that the previous government in the report in 2007 concluded that culling badgers was not the way forward. The report presented to Mr. Miliband, who was then the Environment Secretary. So what's your view on what Jim Pace is saying now as the Agriculture Minister?
Well, Jim Pace has always said these controversial things, hasn't he? You know, I went to a talk by the gentleman who was in charge of this TB vaccination programme, which was going to take place in 6 hotspots throughout England. He said that by strict control and vaccination, they could eliminate, because the badgers, of course, that have got TB, it can do nothing for them. But in 5 years' time, they would have died out. And by constantly vaccinating all the badgers and marking them with this indelible mark that would last forever, that they could get rid of bovine TB in the badger population within 5 years. Now, that's all gone by the board, and all they're looking at now is killing badgers. You know, all
no,
the
Gordon,
evidence, the science...
Sorry, it's George.
These scientists have said over and over again that culling will not work. One little point, you know, people talk about other countries, you know, of what they've done and what a mess, what wonderful things they've done, you know. There's no country in the world that has demonstrated convincingly that the control of a possible wildlife BT vector has ever contributed to the overall control of bovine TB. And that's a fact.
Gordon, Gordon, I have to stop you there, but sorry. can you tell us where to go on the internet or other places to find information from your conservation group?
Well, go on badger/watch.co.uk.
Okay, Gordon, thanks
that's
very much.
Website.
Thanks very much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Anytime.
And that was, in fact, Gordon, not George Lumby, from the Badger Conservation Group in Lampeter in Wales. Okay. Now, as another aid flotilla sets sail across the Mediterranean heading for the Gaza ghetto in occupied Palestine, details of last month's Israeli commando raid are still trickling out. We now hear from Shakir Yildirim at last, one of the two Bristolians who was on board the aid ship.
My name is Shakir Yildirim from Fish Ponds, and how I ended up in that boat, it was planned, and I wanted to go on that boat to be able to help those people in need. Obviously, what I've seen in the past, and they needed cement, so at least I could do my bit and take some cement on to people of Gaza. And that's how I ended up, asked IHH to put me on that boat, so I was one of the lucky people that I heard there was about 10,000 people wanted to go on that boat, so I'm one of the lucky ones.
Now, when the film was shown on the television at the time, we saw people on the boat hitting the Israeli soldiers with big iron bars, and that was going, quite a few people doing that. And also, the Israelis were saying that they were actually shot at first.
Well, the Israelis? With what? Well, I had the weapon as well, myself. Fire extinguisher, but I don't think that was shooting. I couldn't see it. We didn't have no guns. They found some knives as well, kitchen knives. If they're weapons, I don't know. I mean, the kitchen knives are weapons. But we didn't have no weapons. We had no means of shooting at them. How could you shoot a helicopter? I don't know. I don't know. We didn't have anything. So, as they are, always they're lying.
Yes, but they are saying that the only reason that they shot people on the boat was because they were attacked first.
How can they be attacked if they're coming from outside into a ship and international waters? And I think we had every right to defend ourselves from pirates. And there are the pirates, and we did defend ourselves, but we did not shot at them. They came... Imagine someone comes into your house and... you know, what would you do? You're trying to defend yourself, wouldn't you? You wouldn't just let him come in and just rob you and kill you, your wife or kids or so on, and then go back. You defend. That's what we did. We defended ourselves from pirates.
Now, you've got a British passport. How did you find the British embassy in Israel? How did they treat you when you asked for their assistance? Because you were locked up in an Israeli jail.
Well, they asked me for... if I needed a lawyer, when I said yes, he said, have you got any money? I said, I've been robbed. I'm in another country. I've been, hijacked and put in prison. Well, he said, you know, we can't give you that sort of money, but we can supply you the list of solicitors. The rest of it is up to you. I said, can I send a message to my mum or my family? He said, oh, yeah, we could do that. I gave him the number, and later on, a few days later, when I rang my mum from Turkey, and she said, we haven't heard anything from anyone. So British Embassy, they failed on me or any the last three convoys. We always got in touch with them. Three times they failed, complete failure. So if anyone's going on holiday and if you're in trouble, do not phone British Embassy.
You were there on the deck when the Israelis were actually shooting. What did you see?
People getting injured and dying, and dead.
But those people you saw, I mean, could you see any possible reason why they were being shot at? Were they attacking the soldiers?
Well, okay, one of them was taking a photo that he got shot, which he was a journalist. So they had every reason to shoot him because he could use the photos of them killing people. So if he published those, then obviously the public will know, people would know all over the world that what they've been up to. So they shot him, and the other person was just trying to hit away from their guns, and he got shot in the head. And the other one was trying to defend the ship. He was the martial art expert. So obviously he didn't know that they were going to use, live bullets and live rounds, and he got shot.
That was Shakir Yildirim from the kebab shop up in Fishponds there, who was on the Gaza aid convoy, the flotilla, last month. Kathy Come Home, Kes and Land and Freedom are some of his most well-known films. And at a packed public meeting in Eastern Community Centre last week, award-winning director Ken Loach was particularly incensed by the media coverage of the Israeli commando attack on last month's Gaza aid flotilla.
Certain things struck me, and I think struck others, as the news unfolded. First of all, the news was presented repeatedly as a PR disaster for Israel. This was a calamity for Israel. This was a news disaster for Israel. This was a miscalculation for Israel. Well, no, it wasn't, actually. It was a disaster for the Palestinians. It was a disaster for those who were murdered. It was a disaster for those who were blockaded in Gaza. But no, it was presented as a PR disaster for Israel. Now, I mean, just imagine if the situation were reversed. Suppose the Palestinians shot 9 Israelis, and the news was, this is a PR disaster for Hamas. PR disaster, they shot 9 Israelis. What a disaster for the Hamas government. You can't imagine it. And so it's what indicates that actually the story was told from the point of view of the Israeli interest. And it was presented as though it were a legitimate operation which went wrong. A legitimate operation, they were entitled to maintain their blockade, and whoops, we got it wrong. A PR disaster. Another issue was, and this was repeated over and over again by Israeli spokesmen and not challenged by the interviewer, where on the devil's advocate principle, the interviewer adopts the position of the adversary. You know, John Humphries will adopt the position of the adversary in the interview. They don't do it with Israel. What the given was, Israel has a right to security. That was the given, and that was not challenged. Do the Palestinians have a right to security? Not an issue. How did the Palestinians prevent their land being taken? Not an issue. How did the Palestinians prevent their houses being knocked down? The massacres that happened in Gaza? Not an issue. The Palestinians, in those interviews, did not have a right to security. The Israelis had a right to security. And the question was never raised of how does an illegally blockaded people have a right to break the blockade? How does do people whose land is illegally occupied have a right to defend themselves? You think of the Free French during the Second World War. Were the Maquis, were they, did they, of course we all say they had a right to resist the illegal occupation. If we'd been occupied, no doubt we would have had the right to resist. But the Palestinians, no. They have no right to resist. They have no right to security. There's one example of many, and I just jotted one down, but it used to get my blood pressure soaring every morning like it did yours, I'm sure. But one small example of this bias. The UN, and on the Today programme, they had a UN spokesman who spoke about the need for the people in Gaza to have supplies. They then had an Israeli spokesman who denied it. No Palestinian. Nobody spoke from Gaza. So you had the UN. The UN is like the objective force. I mean, the UN is a prime source of international law. The UN is not partisan. The Palestinians were not allowed to speak. And of course, we know there's no shortage of Palestinians who will speak, and who will speak very eloquently. There's one other interesting parallel that I think we might reflect on. You may remember 2 years ago, British sailors were captured by Iranians. 15 British sailors were captured by Iranians, and they were alleged to have broken international law in some respect in Iranian waters. They were taken to Iran, and then they were questioned, and then they were let go. The press and the television were up in arms. Why didn't they fight back? Was the question. Why didn't they fight back? They were allowed to be taken too easily. Now, of course, the question is, when it was quite clear that the people in the convoy didn't fight back, the same questions are not put. The question, did they have the right to fight back, of course, is not questioned. The question that is put, with the inversion of the evidence, that they were hitting people before they were fired on. And, of course, we know from that video that the Israelis fired first. But just think how that capture of the British sailors was dealt with, and think about how... Just imagine if the Iranians had shot 9 sailors. Dear God, we'd have Third World War. Yeah.
Just to say also that the video that Ken Loach was referring to there was a video which wasn't shown on television, but which emerged about a week after the attacks. Anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts on what Ken Loach, the film director, had to say at Eastern Community Centre last week?
Well, I think it's quite clear that the Israelis do get an easy ride in the Western media. I mean, we had a discussion some weeks ago on this programme, if you remember, with an expert on media coverage of the conflict. Can I just make the point that an aspect of this which has not been widely reported or understood in the media is that the democratically elected government of Turkey, the Erdogan government, which is a sort of moderate Islamist government, has been under subversive attack by the Israelis. There is evidence to suggest that the Israelis have been coordinating with the Ergenekon network inside the Turkish armed forces. Ergenekon is spelled Ergenekon, and I encourage listeners to do a computer search about that. Ergenekon is effectively the Turkish branch of Gladio, GLADIO, which is essentially involved in terrorist promotion of terrorism inside Turkey in order to subvert democratic government, and that the Israeli Mossad were cooperating with this structure, and that a couple of years ago there was an attempt to overthrow the democratic government in Turkey by the military with the connivance and the encouragement of the Israeli secret service Mossad.
But I mean, Ergenekon is an extreme nationalist movement, so why would it be conducting terrorism?
It's extreme nationalist movement, but it's extreme nationalist secularist movement. Don't forget that the Turkish army is integrated into NATO, so ultimately they take their orders not from inside Turkey but from Brussels, shape in Brussels, which is the head of NATO, and of course that really effectively means the Americans and a little bit of the British deciding what happens. So the army in Turkey, like in many developing countries, is effectively a Trojan horse for Western interests. What the Turkish people need and want is only secondary, and we've had military government in Turkey for many decades. They've been in and out of power. Every attempt to try and establish democracy in Turkey until recently has been overturned by the military. That military, of course, all trained at Sandhurst. So what we're actually dealing with here is a subversive military, which isn't in fact loyal to its own country, and that's a big problem in lots of countries in the world.
Turkey's an important country to keep an eye on, isn't it? Because being a member of NATO and a Muslim country, and in many ways that NATO is actually at war with some of the more, should we say, extreme elements of Islam.
No, NATO in theory is not supposed to be at war with Islam. I mean, that's effectively how it's perceived in popular consciousness. But of course it's not. It's supposedly the North Atlantic Treaty Organization to defend the Atlantic states against attack by outside forces like the Russians.
What about the Turkish boat that was attacked by the Israeli commando?
Well, indeed. I mean, there was a very, very... according to Craig Murray, the ex-British ambassador in Uzbekistan, there was a very, very hard meeting at NATO headquarters in Brussels where the Turks basically said, look, our boats are being attacked. We want to invoke the NATO charter. So let's call in an airstrike on the Israelis then, shall we? As we did on Serbia, for example. And of course, there was an embarrassed silence and a lot of coughing when this kind of thing was discussed. But of course, what's actually happening is that Turkey, under its democratic leadership, is slipping out of the orbit of the West. And the Turkish government is no doubt very aware that they're going to be destabilised by the Western powers and by Israel if they carry on the course they're pursuing. But they're quite tough. They've been through this quite a lot of times before. They do realise what they're up against.
Martin, thanks very much. Now, secret government, parallel government, shadow government, could they really exist? British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli said in his 1844 novel Coningsby that the world is governed by very different personages to what is imagined by those who are not themselves behind the scenes. More recently, David Rockefeller, a US magnate from the oil industry and the banking industry, said in Newsweek International of February the 1st, 1999, that somebody has to take government's place, and business seems to me a logical entity to do it. Even Her Majesty the Queen was quoted in conversation with Royal Butler Paul Burrell back in 1999, saying, "There are powers at work in this country about which we have no knowledge." But we're going to start today with John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who was assassinated in Dallas, Texas, on the 22nd of November 1963. And here he is, a few months before he was shot, addressing journalists at the National Press Club, explaining, "We are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy."
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program, for from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people. For I have complete confidence in the response and dedication of our citizens whenever they are fully informed.
That was President John Fitzgerald Kennedy there talking to journalists at the National Press Club in the United States. Martin, when Kennedy talks about being opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy, what is he talking about?
I think he's referring to the communist system, the communist governments in China and in Russia.
But why was it called a conspiracy? Because, I mean, as it transpired, actually, the US state was really destroying communism when communists were being democratically elected in places like Chile.
Yes, I know, but I mean, don't forget that there were other places where communists weren't democratically elected, and what Kennedy's doing there is contrasting the unfree system in the communist bloc, where criticism is suppressed and so on, with the ideal in the West Western setup, where in actual fact, you know, there's an openness and full debate and disclosure. I think it's quite interesting to think that we now have the US Patriot Act on the books in the United States, incidentally rushed through without anybody properly reading it, even though it was a massive act.
Well, it's a bit like our Terrorism Act 2000 here in Britain.
Yeah, well, but even more so. And of course, most people don't realise that the Patriot Act actually is an acronym. It stands for something, the prevention and something of terrorism, something. But of course, it's the whole thing smells fishy. And what it has done, in fact, is abrogate many of the constitutional rights which Americans are taught in their schools that they have. So the United States today is a more secretive and a more locked down society than it was in the days of John F. Kennedy.
Television in the 1980s was very different to the lowest common denominator soaps, game shows, and some biased news and documentaries we get today. Professional standards in the days before satellite, cable, and digiboxes were high, and there was a commitment by the four channels we had then to investigative journalism, which struck at the root of corruption, which, with all the hundreds of channels we have today, television is a shadow of its former self. One of the most hard-hitting investigative journalists of the 80s was Duncan Campbell, not to be confused with the Guardian crime reporter of the same name. So fearless were Campbell's programmes that one series, called simply Secret Society, was nearly never shown at all. In 1986, MI5 and Special Branch raided BBC Scotland's offices in Edinburgh, where the programme was being produced, and took the entire production office away in transit vans. For some reason, the BBC have not yet released this series on DVD, which covered the following topics. The secret constitution, that is, secret cabinet committees. There was another programme looking at databases, secret government databases. Another one called In Time of Crisis, which looked at government emergency powers. Another one examining the Association of Chief Police Officers, that's ACPO, who Campbell alleged were making up their own law and policy. Another programme, which was probably the most famous one, which was Zircon, about the government communications headquarters in Cheltenham, GCHQ, with particular reference to a secret £500 million satellite. And finally, A Gap in Our Defences, about bungling defence manufacturers and incompetent military planners who botched every new radar system that Britain has installed since World War II. Probably the most controversial of the lot was the programme on secret cabinet committees, where massive decisions were made by unnamed bureaucrats, and even members of the cabinet itself were not allowed to know what was going on.
This pageantry cloaks the British Constitution, but what's really at its heart? Have you ever heard of parts of it called MISC 7, OD, ODSA, Gen 29, MISC 94, or the LF? What do you think they are? In some ways, these organisations are more secret than MI5 or MI6, and there are many more of them. These mysterious initials are amongst any Prime Minister's most closely guarded secrets. These are the organisations who have really decided critical national issues over the last 10 years. Issues like the economy, the coal strike, the Falklands War, or nuclear weapons and defence policy. And you've probably never heard of any of them. They're actually the secret titles of government cabinet committees. The cryptic initials aren't there to fool the Russians. The problem is Britain and us. Unlike Parliament, only the Queen has a right to know how the cabinet actually does its work, even if she doesn't always ask. But the committee system is secret from everyone else, and that often includes government ministers.
My lords and members of the House of Commons.
So cabinet committees are the big secret of prime ministerial power. That power's most vulnerable, but most critical, at the time of a general election. In the last two elections, the outgoing governments used such committees for unusual tactics, which, like details of the committees themselves, have no place in the textbooks that are supposed to teach us about the British Constitution.
The way it's taught is a combination of two things, magic and probity. The British Constitution is taught as a secret garden because it's not written down, and yet it's something magnificent. Probity is always stressed because it's accountability first and foremost. Civil servants are accountable to ministers, ministers are accountable to Parliament, and above all, the Prime Minister is accountable twice a week in the House of Commons. This is why it is claimed always, and it's now a cliché, Watergate could not happen in this country. The reality is rather different. The reality is such that these neat lines of command break down routinely.
All secret committees are set up on the Prime Minister's own authority. There are certain cabinet committees which are what you might call run-of-the-mill cabinet committees, which, though not public, are almost semi-public.
Even cabinet ministers don't necessarily know who's on what committee.
Oh, no, you can sit in the cabinet and feel totally disfranchised. I remember one of Mrs. Thatcher's ministers saying to me, you're always banging on about open government, more open government. She doesn't believe in open government for us, let alone people like you.
That was Peter Hennessy and Duncan Campbell there on Secret Cabinet Committees from the 1986 series Secret Society, which, at least in part, led to Victor Rothschild asking BBC chairman Marmaduke Hussey to sack the last generally respected BBC director-general, Alastair Milne. Prime Minister Harold Wilson resigned in March 1976. He was being harassed by Britain's internal security service, MI5, some of whom believed he was working for the Russian spy agency, the KGB. There was even talk of a military coup amongst senior right-wing army officers, two of them travelling to Clarence House not long before Wilson resigned to ask permission to carry out the coup from Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother. Her reply was curt, "Oh, no, dears, that would never do." The BBC reported on MI5's harassment of Wilson 10 years later in 1986, in the midst of the Spycatcher affair. The Spycatcher book by Peter Wright was banned, but talked about MI5 bugging and burgling their way around London.
On the 16th of March 1976, Lord Wilson, Harold Wilson as he then was, caused a sensation by resigning as Prime Minister only 2 years after coming back into office. Lord Wilson's sudden and unforced departure from 10 Downing Street intrigued political observers. But even the conspiracy theorists have concluded, after all this time, that Harold and Mary Wilson were simply tired of the rigours of power. Less than 2 months later, Lord Wilson did another extraordinary thing. He invited into his home here in Lord North Street, Westminster, two young BBC journalists who he had never met before. Over 2.5 hours, he proceeded to make a series of revelations about his fears and mistrust of MI5 and MI6, the two secret security services of which, as Prime Minister, he had been the ultimate boss. Then, and in further meetings, he made known to them a series of allegations and concerns. For 8 months as Prime Minister, he said he hadn't known what was going on in the security services. He pointed to spectacular mistakes made by MI5 over the vetting of ministers. Lord Wilson believed he was the victim of electronic surveillance and phone tapping of his home. He was alarmed by more than a dozen unexplained burglaries affecting him, his friends and advisers. He thought a campaign of smears and black propaganda had been directed against his entourage. And a group of far-right people in the Secret Service, he said, had put it about that there was a communist cell in Number 10. From the moment he entered office in March 1974, Lord Wilson's fears had been mounting until they reached a crisis point in August 75.
His suspicions and worries had become so great that he approached the head of both security services, Maurice Oldfield and Sir Michael Hanley, not together at separate times, and asked what the hell was going on, and was given the answer from both these gentlemen that, yes, there was a faction within each of the services, but particularly five, who were out of control, who were anti the Wilson government, and who were involved in some kind of smear campaign.
Well, I don't think Wilson was paranoid about this. I mean, I think that he had genuine reason to believe that he was under surveillance from the group. I mean, otherwise he wouldn't have gone to that amazing scene. It must have been really interesting in Number 10 when there was a Prime Minister confronting the two heads of the services and asking them whether they could control their own officers and if they were prepared to accept ministerial control. It must be the nearest thing that they've seen in Britain to the possibility of a takeover by a secret police force.
Lord Wilson's immediate entourage of advisers and friends, the kitchen cabinet as they became known, attracted many hangers-on. And the Prime Minister had become worried about two people in particular whose activities seemed suspicious.
At this point, Wilson's suspicions had become so acute that he totally bypassed our own security services and, using his publisher, Lord Weidenfeld, sent a message direct to Hubert Humphrey to request the assistance of the CIA in checking these people out. They were both British subjects, and I find it extraordinary, and the Americans indeed must have found it extraordinary, and what it told them about the situation here in Britain at the time is anybody's guess. But the British Prime Minister should be requesting help in that peculiar way, clearly not trusting his own security services, is appalling, I think.
The CIA's director at that time, George Bush, made a special detour to London in early 1976 to talk to Lord Wilson, and he assured him that although one of the suspects was known to the CIA, neither were part of any CIA operation. But within weeks, the press and public became obsessed with another political event. Although Lord Wilson continued to expound his fears and theories about the security services to the two young BBC men here in Lord North Street, the outside world was less than agog. Many people, including some of Harold Wilson's own close advisers, thought that he was frayed, exhausted, and frankly imagining things.
Now, Martin, that report was done a decade after Harold Wilson resigned in 1986 by the BBC. But why do you think that MI5 and MI6 might have taken against the Prime Minister?
Well, I think it's quite interesting that Wilson approached the CIA to ask whether his own security services were reliable. And, of course, he got George Bush Sr. came along and said, yes, there's no problem with your security services. It seems to me that what you had there was an alliance between elements within the British security services and their American colleagues to undermine the democratically elected government of Britain. The main gripe from the American side and from the side of many of the British establishment was that Wilson had refused to fight in Vietnam, unlike Australia and New Zealand, who sent their young people to die in that pointless exercise. We've ended up in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we've learned our lesson, haven't we?
So do you think a lot has changed since then about certain parts of military intelligence actually, you know, sort of pushing politicians in a particular direction and intimidating them if they don't come up with the results that they want?
To be honest with you, I think since the war on terror, so-called, was declared in 2001, the situation has got worse. The politicians, by and large, are terrified of the security services. They have no idea what they're up to. They're not really interested in trying to find out because they know that if they start looking, they're not going to like what they see. So we have this conspiracy of silence, if you like, not to discuss these points. We really do have to get to grips with the unaccountable nature of power, both in this country and in the United States. Our elected politicians really are Boy Scouts in a man's war. They don't really know what they're dealing with. They're easily manipulated. They're terribly naive about what goes on. And we must educate ourselves to be a lot tougher than we have been.
Now, MI5 and MI6 are supposed to be totally accountable through the Intelligence and Security Committee and various other government offices, but that's the most important one, probably, is a parliamentary committee.
Yeah, but as it was pointed out at the beginning of the piece, there's lots of other organisations besides MI5 and MI6. So the line of accountability isn't quite clear even so. I mean, they're not accountable in actual fact, as has been proved on many occasions. For example, this whole question of an inquiry into 7-7, which we're going to look into next week. MI5 have refused to testify to a proper inquest, and they don't want to actually be accountable to the basic legal infrastructure of the country.
I believe they are testifying, Martin, but behind a screen.
Well, yeah, they've also negotiated about what they are and are not prepared to say. Now, the fact is that they've become a law unto themselves. The whole business around Lockerbie, for example, is another example of this. There is fairly clear evidence that the Libyan Megrahi was not responsible and was about to appeal and successfully appeal against his conviction. The implication being that elements within the US security forces, probably the CIA, had tampered with the crime scene to point Libya, the finger at Libya. That's a crime under Scottish law, but that's why we don't want to look into these things. An awful lot of what's going on is criminal behaviour, which would have to be prosecuted if you started looking at it.
So, is there a secret government, a parallel government in the West? Florida computer science teacher David Shedrow believes he's identified a super-rich private club that controls the US government. No Republican or Democrat can succeed without them. He also reveals that they have an equivalent here in Britain. Now, I don't know what's happened to David there, but I guess we'll have to bring you that report lot. Oh, hang on. Nope.
Who's Who, under his description, they had a reference to something called the Psychological Strategy Board.
Dave is talking about Henry Kissinger here.
And from there, I found out that that was really established by the Council on Foreign Relations. It was used to really sway political opinion in America, but it was a government organization. And I did a lot more digging into them and found out that they had control of our government. After Eisenhower got in, the Psychological Strategy Board was replaced by something called the Operations Coordinating Board. The Psychological Strategy Board evidently was piquing people's interest just by what it was called. And they changed the name to something more benign, the Operations Coordinating Board. The Operations Coordinating Board was composed of the Undersecretary of State, and most of the Secretary of States in all our governmental administrations have been members of the Council on Foreign Relations. The Director of Central Intelligence, most of the Central Intelligence Agency's members were also members of the Council on Foreign Relations. They're a group of very, very rich and influential people. There's about 4,000 members, and they work in a manner that was really derived by Cecil Rhodes when he figured out these roundtable groups. The idea was it was a secret organization, and it would be made of circles within circles, and the inner circle were the real ones that were going to run the show, and outer circles knew less and less of what was going on, but they were chosen because they were influential people, and they could influence other people that could get things done that the organization wanted to get done. And this is very much the way the Council on Foreign Relations operates today. They control the news. If you take a look at their list of people at CBS that are members of the Council on Foreign Relations include William Paley, William Burden, Roswell Gilpatrick, Henry Shack, Minetta Tree, C.C. Collingwood at NBC, Jane Pfeiffer, Aaron Burnett, Lester Crystal, R.W. Sonnenfeld, ABC, Ray Adam, Frank Carey, Newsday, Jessica Matthew, L.A. Times Mirror, Richard W. Murphy, Charles A. Capuchan, L.A. Times Syndicate, Thomas Johnson, and you can go on and on with this thing forever. They have people working in all the major news services. This group is a think tank. They have very smart people from universities. They have a lot of control in the university system. When you meet these people, you would like to invite them home and have them over for dinner. They have people like Barbara Walters and Ted Koppel and some very nice people that are part of their group. You trust them, but you just don't know that they belong to the Council on Foreign Relations. I think it's important to expose this group because one of the ways they work is by trying to stay out of the news. Very few people in America have actually heard the name of this group itself. I would imagine the same is true in England. I doubt if a lot of people have heard of the Royal Institute of International Affairs. These people like to work behind the scenes. If people knew how much influence and power these groups had over their lives, what they were doing, I don't think they would put up with it. There's a lot of Council on Foreign Relations people that appear on TV. Their affiliation with the Council on Foreign Relations is never explored. Tim Geithner has been brought in front of congressional hearings and has been on television for numerous hours over the last several months. Never once has anyone asked him whether he belonged to the Council on Foreign Relations or if they have any influence over him. Or there's people in Congress that are members of the Council on Foreign Relations. There's a couple of people on the Supreme Court that are members of the Council on Foreign Relations. This is a very influential group. I'm not sure what kind of world they want, but from what I see, it's a world that they control and that they're the masters of.
That's David Shedrow there from Florida talking about the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, Martin, you said that someone else has just been recruited.
George Clooney's just been recruited to the Council
George
on Foreign
Clooney?
Relations. George Clooney? Yeah, the liberal actor. I think another network that people might want to look into is the Trilateral Commission. I think we've got networks within networks, as a contributor was saying, which actually control things, but we need to examine these things much more closely than we have done.
And he was talking about a British equivalent, which is called the Royal Institute for International Affairs. Anyway, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Music is up next, and the most pleasant mashup to the weekend with Sam, that's AJ, aka DJ Spungold. Thanks very much to this week's guest in the first hour, Labour Councillor for St George East, Ron Stone, and thanks to Neil Evans for his badger-hugging report. And of course, to our permanent fixture, old Labour economist Martin Summers. Next week, Bristol's new Conservative MP, Charlotte Leslie, and the London bombings. As the fifth anniversary approaches, we have an exclusive interview with the brother of one of the victims.
Here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.